The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So let's begin with a short sitting, and then I'll introduce the day. And so consider for a little bit, what experiences you've had of the conventional idea of being awake? Are there some clear experiences in your life of that you can remember when you felt, you know, awake in the conventional ways? Really awake. Or if you consider, just do the, and then consider what it feels like to be clearly awake in the conventional ways. How do you usually feel energetically when you're nicely awake? How does your mind feel when you're awake? What are your perceptions like? Your faculty of perception, what's it like when you clearly feel awake? What degree of clarity or presence do you have about the present, your present moment experience? How vivid is the present when you're awake? When the conventional feeling of being awake stands out in your experience, it's highlighted somehow, this clarity of it, is there any sense of well-being that you feel with that wakefulness? What's the nature of the well-being you feel? When you are knowingly awake in a conventional way, you really feel awake. Are you more likely to be reactive to what's happening or more likely to be non-reactive? In that experience of being awake, what place and role does self have in it? Self-image, self-attachment, self-consciousness? Do you have more self, less self? When you're clearly awake? And as you're sitting here now, can you recognize that part of awareness that is awake now? Even if you're sleepy, are there parts of you that feel more awake than other parts? Noticing whatever wakefulness is here now, and how the experience of being awake or wakeful does not belong to the world of thinking. It's outside or beyond or bigger than the activity of thinking about anything. differentiate better, to have more greater clarity about the differences of things, and to say that, eating oatmeal, eating cornmeal for breakfast, you know, it's all the same to me, it's just what's happening. That's interesting to say that, it has some importance, but it's also interesting to be actually taste the difference between oatmeal and cornmeal, and know what those differences are. So if there's differences between being sleepy and versus awake, without putting value on one or the other, then what are those differences? And overcome some of your resistance or reluctance if you have that. And as I said, some of it is high risk. I don't know if today's going to be high risk, maybe. But, if there's not some risk involved in a spiritual practice, then I don't think spiritual practice is worth it. So if it's only supposed to make us comfortable, I don't think that's, then it's not really working. So hopefully you're willing to be a little bit uncomfortable as we do this as well. Seven qualities of mind or heart that, when they get developed, lead to awakening. And for someone who is awakened, the seven factors of awakening are often part of that experience of awakening as well, in some way or other. But the most important way they're emphasized in the tradition is how they lead to awakening, they support awakening. It means that there are some wonderful qualities, inner strengths that get developed that make it easier for the mind, the heart, to let go. Letting go sometimes is quite challenging, sometimes quite frightening, and even sometimes hearing the Buddhist teachings of letting go of your attachment to self, can seem very threatening to some people. But when you also hear that that letting go is supported by the cultivation, development of strong inner strengths. So these inner strengths are mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. These seven qualities are sometimes been considered the crown jewels of Buddhism. There's a one sutta where, just like an ancient monarch had seven royal jewels, so the Buddha has seven royal jewels. And it's these seven qualities. They are quite beautiful qualities. As they became, as I touched into them in my own practice, I was surprised by them. I was surprised by the strength of them and the clarity in which they appeared in my experience. When I read about them before, they were all kind of muddled together and, oh yeah, it makes sense, or just, I don't know what I thought. But then as on my retreats, and as my concentration and mindfulness got stronger, and these started to stand out and highlight, I was really very surprised by the clarity and the succinctness and the strength with which these things appear, and how it sometimes in practice they become the predominant experience. That they become very so strong that they become kind of like really what stands out in the highlight compared to other things that are going on. So they're very important qualities in practice. The reason why I chose to do it this year, every year we do a different theme for the Dharma practice days for the year, and the reason I chose this one is because last year we did the five hindrances. And in this teachings of the Buddha, there's a clear relationship between the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. And you see in a lot of the suttas that these two are paired together. For example, let's say that the seven factors of the five hindrances are those forces of the mind that blind us, that obscure our wisdom. Seven factors of awakening are those which give us light or clarity, able to see clearly, remove our blindness, and support the growth of wisdom. So they they have opposite effects on us. And so the course of practice is one to go, the simplest description of the course of practice in Buddhism is to go from being caught in the hindrances to being supported by the seven factors of awakening. And so they're paired quite a bit. One description that compares these two, it says, just like a small seed can germinate and grow into a very big, tall tree, whose canopy covers the other trees in the forest. So the other trees in the forest wither and die. So the hindrances can be born from a small seed in their mind. And they can grow to become really big, so big that they form a canopy that shade all the other kind of more shy or more weaker qualities, good qualities within us, and they wither and die. So that's what the hindrances can do when you're caught up in desire and addiction, and caught up in ill will and hate, and caught up in sloth and torpor and restlessness and anxiety and doubt. When you're really caught in those in big time, they can have a very powerful detrimental effect on our lives. The seven factors of awakening are those things that are those states where those seeds have not grown, the canopy is not taken over, and so that the light of the sun can come in. When the Buddha was about to die, getting ready for his death, preparing his community for his dying, he gave some of the last teachings, and one of the things he said was that he said, what I have discovered, so this is the Buddha's going to say what he discovered just before he dies. This is a pretty important moment, right? And he says, what I discovered is, and what he doesn't do is he doesn't say a teaching, doesn't say a doctrine, this is the truth. Rather, what he says is, I discovered particular qualities of mind, qualities of heart, inner qualities that get developed. And one of the lists he mentioned is the seven factors of awakening. That's what he developed. In another place, the Buddha says, it's an interesting passage. He says, sometimes I give teachings to a large body of people. And it happens sometimes that people in the audience think that I'm directing my teachings just for them personally. And he says, that's not the case. He says, that's not the case. I only teach for the purpose of giving instruction. That's interesting, huh? Instruction as opposed to teaching the truth, some abstract idea of truth, the doctrine, and stuff like that. The Buddha teaches instructions for awakening. That's more important than teachings about the nature of awakening, the instructions for how to get awakened. And so the seven factors of awakening is part of that body of instructions. There are many different schools of Buddhism, many different approaches to Buddhism, and perhaps they can all be seen as the branches of the great tree of Buddhism, but what they all have in common is the sap that runs through them. And awakening and these seven factors of awakening are the sap that support and develop the whole tree that we all have in common. And without awakening, without some reference to awakening, it's all too easy for Buddhism to become a servant of popular values, of societal values, and just be swept along and become, support people's greed, hate and delusion, neurosis, preferences, ideas of self. But it's the awakening and reference to awakening that really makes Buddhism an alternative to some of the more unhealthy popular values of any society at all, and protects Buddhism from just simply being a servant to whatever the popular ideas are of the moment or of the year or whatever, personal preferences. So having some reference point to awakening is very important in Buddhism. It's said that one of the most common way of presenting the seven factors of awakening is to present them in sequence. One develops the next. So as we do mindfulness practice, as the mindfulness gets stronger, it develops our capacity almost naturally, without any effort almost, and develops a capacity to investigate, to see more clearly and explore what's actually going on here. As we investigate and explore more clearly, that tends to give rise to greater engagement, with the whole process of practice. We understand, we see better what's going on, and so we're more engaged. We know how to engage, so we get more engaged. There's more energy there. As we get more engaged in the practice, it tends to produce a sense of well-being. Engagement, we really be engaged, fully engaged in almost any activity at all, tends to produce well-being. And so as we get more and more engaged in the practice, it gives birth to well-being, which here in this list is called joy. And then as the joy, as the mind becomes more joyful, then it tends to relax the body. The body tends to become calm, is what the Buddha said. And I think that's often the case. As a sense of well-being is there, it allows us to relax and our tensions and stuff. As we become more relaxed and calm, it's easier to get concentrated. The concentration often comes naturally when the mind has let go and is calm, very kind of tranquil. And then as the mind gets more concentrated, it's natural or easier, what follows is greater sense of equanimity. A balance of mind comes from that. So for the Buddha, there was a kind of idea that these are sequential. They develop one after the other. They can also be there all together. And so there's also a way in which they're also discussed in the suttas and as being something that exists in relationship to each other and in balance with each other. And part of, in certain points in practice, it becomes relevant for a practitioner to actually try to bring the seven factors of awakening into balance with each other. There might be strong concentration, but not enough equanimity. Or there might be, like when I remember I was on long retreat, and I started talking to my teachers about my experience of the seven factors of awakening, because they stood out in the highlight, and they were important, and I was kind of, adjusting them, and the relative strengths and all that. And then my teachers gave me two pieces of, two reflections on me. One was, at some point they told me, "Gil, stop tinkering." But the other thing they told me was, one teacher told me, "Gil, this is great, you keep coming in here and talking about the seven factors of awakening, but I've noticed that in talking about them, you're actually never talking about equanimity." I hadn't noticed I'd left one out. It's probably the quality I'd most needed to bring it all into balance. Well, adjusting them. Rather than just relying on mindfulness, just seeing what's there, I was thinking, look at that, they need a little more energy here, maybe a little more tranquility here, sharpen this, sharpen. Rather than noticing, the energy is a little bit low, just what's that like, seeing that. So my approach to teaching this year, Seven Factors of Awakening, is based on two ideas. One idea is that it's helpful to be able to recognize these factors when they occur. And I feel that to some degree they're part of human experience. They're there interspersed in what we do. But often we don't notice them. We don't. We validate certain things, and we tend to focus on certain things and not other things. And there's a huge array of things that are happening in the present moment. So a person might not notice that they're relaxed because they are so absorbed in the television program that they're watching. And I heard about a new one yesterday. Maybe it's not new for me. Gossip Girls. You know about Gossip Girls? No, you don't. I wonder how relaxed. A friend of mine told me his 14-year-old daughter is watching Gossip Girls, and I wonder how relaxed she is watching it. Anyway, the point being that what we focus on to some degree affects what gets developed and what gets supported. The Buddha talked about things being nourished. And what you focus on nourishes certain things, feeds certain things and other things. So if you focus on what you hate, you nourish the hindrance of ill will. If you focus on what you want, you might nourish the hindrance of desire. If you focus on mindfulness, you nourish mindfulness. If you focus on the quality of joy that arises, then you nourish and support that joy. Simply by noticing things, the noticing itself feeds some certain things. And so by noticing things that are present, it tends to feed that. It's an interesting story I heard this week. A friend of mine's wife has been quite sick with an autoimmune disease. And it's been years, 7, 8 years of being very, very sick, hardly can get out of bed, takes 4 naps a day, very sleepy, very drained, no energy in the body because the hypothalamus or something's operating, always kind of trying to attack, and as if she has the flu, and very devastating. She had all kinds of treatments, all kinds of tests. And the latest theory that she received, or approach that she received from a doctor, is that there's nothing wrong with her. You know, there's no illness, there's no bacteria or virus that her body actually has. But somehow her immune system has set itself as in constant attack, constantly attacking something that's not there. And so the approach that this doctor's approach is that she has to live as if she's not sick, so that her system inside gets a different message. And she said it was very hard to override these very strong feelings of just being so tired and lethargic and, you know, whatever, sleepy. And so it took a lot of effort, but this is the first thing that's helped her in 8 years. She's not out of the woods yet, but she feels so good. She's not napping during the day now, and she goes to the store occasionally, and, you know, and her husband says, my wife is back. You know, I have someone that can now we hang out and talk and spend time together. And so, you know, I wouldn't want to generalize this for all kinds of conditions, but it is an example of, you know, what we focus on can sometimes have a big impact. And so for this year, last year we focused on the hindrances, so I apologize for that. And so now we're going to make up for that by...
You notice
you
have a bigger crowd.
So focus on the factors of awakening. So one approach I have is that just simply recognizing, learning to identify them is supportive, allows them to grow. And that there are conventional, ordinary experiences of the factors of awakening in our ordinary practice or ordinary life, and that we can recognize them and use them in our life. The other approach is that as your meditation practice deepens, and hopefully over time it deepens, perhaps on retreat or over the years of your practice, that these factors become more relevant and highlight in your meditation practice as well. And then having a good sense of what they are hopefully is more supportive of your meditation practice than a distraction. They can be a distraction if you are trying to make them occur. If you're trying to, are they there yet, you know, and is this that experience, you know, do I have it, you know, or trying to manufacture it, you know, that's just not good. But if you recognize, oh, this is what's happening now, and this is really the predominant experience, and I've heard about this before, I know about this, I know that there's a useful way of including it now in my practice, now that they're here, that'll support you as well. So that's kind of the basic kind of background idea that I have for offering this. So with that as an introduction, do you have any questions that you'd like to ask about this so far?
Gil, where do loving kindness and compassion fit into the factors of enlightenment? Is that what naturally comes with joy, perhaps, or
no? It doesn't. When loving kindness and compassion, these practices are cultivated, and they become strong in a person with a strong sense of concentration and stability as part of it. Then the seven factors of awakening come in the wake of that. Come along with it. They get developed with it. And so a very strong loving kindness practice will have the seven factors as part of it as well. Charlotte?
Did the tinkering work? Ever?
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And the closer, the more mature a person's practice becomes, the more developed, well, I don't want to say that, maybe I don't want to say it that way, but at various points in meditation practice, it becomes really crucial not to tinker. And different people to different points. Some people are compulsive tinkers, and it just gets in their way. And some people are too complacent, and they're actually, it'd be good to get them to encourage them to kind of just make some subtle adjustments here, you know, just sit up straighter, have more energy. So it depends on each person, the phase of a person's practice, what goes on. But for me, there was a time when it helped, and there was a time that it didn't.
Can I actually just continue on that thread of thought? I totally appreciate it, because I've been thinking about the tinkering since you mentioned it, and because my initial response is, under which circumstances is that not practicing with an optimal state in mind? And it seems to me that it would be sometimes necessary and sometimes a hindrance or sometimes counterconstructive. So could you describe what you meant by point? You were just in your statement, you said at some point it's helpful.
Oh.
I want to hear more about that point.
Well, I don't know. I don't say anything. What I feel like saying won't answer your question. It's just when it's helpful, it's helpful. When it's not, it's not. When it supports the growth of greater mindfulness and concentration, presence, relax, when it helps supports a greater non-clinging, then it's helpful. If we cling more, get more agitated, or less mindful, more caught up, more tense, then it's not helpful. One of the things we're supposed to do in meditation is monitor ourselves just enough. Meditation involves partly a self-monitoring, where you monitor yourself just enough that you know what's going on, you know the effect you have, you know quality of your mindfulness, quality of your practice, and so you kind of know, you know, what's useful to do, what's helpful to do. I mean, so for example, if I've sat and meditated and kind of thought I was watching my breath, you know, congratulate myself, Gil, you're with your breath, that's nice, but really, you know, I was off, you know, in some fantasy world, and I didn't have enough self-monitoring to notice that my attention was not really that clear and present, and that I was really just drifting off and planning my vacation or whatever I was doing. And so there wasn't any self-monitoring, self-awareness enough to what's going on. Once I become aware enough of that, then I can make an adjustment or tinker in the language of today. I can say, okay, well, enough of vacation planning. I think what I need to do is really bring myself closer in to that experience of breathing, make it more intimate, you know, stronger.
When would you say that investigation runs into tinkering? Because it seems like investigation would be a sort of the first impulse to look at, and then you continue to look at, and then you continue, kind of you pick at it, and then pretty soon you're trying to manipulate.
I meant tinkering as a neutral word. Manipulating is more of a pejorative term, but maybe tinkering meant, you know, maybe you take it pejoratively as an unhealthy thing to do. It's appropriate, you know, practice has a lot to do with not just being with things as they are, which is a very powerful thing to do, but being with things as they are, but also having the clarity of seeing where the choices are between being caught and not caught, between being resisting and not resisting, between suffering and not suffering. So part of the function of investigation is to be able to distinguish between that which is conducive towards freedom from suffering and that which leads to more suffering. And then you're not expected just to suffer better because you're mindful. You're supposed, you know, there's hopefully we learn healthy skills, healthy ways of letting go of the clinging or letting go of those tendencies which are not helpful and cultivating those are helpful. But we have to be very careful with this because there are plenty of people who are way too compulsive in always trying to adjust and fix and do this and that. And it often comes along with a very strong sense of self. It can come, I'm in charge, I'm the agent, it's up to me, I'm going to have a better experience. It can also come along with other things like fear, or trying to prove myself. If I have the right experience, then I'll be successful, I'll be a good Buddhist, I'll be the best spiritual person in my block. And so, and there's a lot of things that can come along with the adjustment process that goes on in practice. So that's why self-monitoring and honesty is very important. We have to see what we're doing. And because a lot of people who are so compulsive about all this kind of stuff, and there's so much self and so much attachment involved, there's a lot of people who are really well served by spending a big block of time practicing doing nothing. Just being present, just being mindful in a very pure way without adjusting or changing anything, just relying on mindfulness practice. And it's a very powerful thing to do. Just relying on mindfulness itself and not doing any adjustments. Sooner or later we have to practice that. Sometimes sooner, sometimes later, sometimes both. But it's a very powerful medicine, and a very powerful way of kind of becoming true or coming into the truth is to just practice kind of a being practice where we simply are using mindfulness to notice what is, without any attempt to change it or evaluate it or do anything. But even that involves a small tinkering adjustment. And that is to keep coming back to mindfulness, relying on mindfulness. In a little bit of sense, stepping back from the way in which we manipulate and involve. And the very attempt to step away from manipulating our experience is a manipulating our experience. You can't get away from it. Even though it might seem like your instruction is don't do anything. Don't manipulate, just be present, just be mindful. So sometimes we can fall into that and it's very stable, very strong, that experience. And becomes kind of, we're coursing in that kind of way of being. But oftentimes, in the initial stages of the practice, that instruction itself involves a subtle. Make sense? Boy, I didn't know that tinkering word would evoke so much, but it's probably good to talk about this. So let's take a 15-minute break. We'll start again at 11. And enjoy your break and have tea and talk to each other.